Ready to take your verdicts and jury selection to the next level? Jury consultant Harry Plotkin and trial lawyer Dan Kramer are your ticket to tipping the scales before trial begins. You're not just picking a jury, you're picking justice. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
Hello, welcome back to another episode of Picking Justice. Harry, how are you doing, man?
I'm doing great. I mean, when we're filming this right now, we're kind of in a little lull in the trial calendar right now, but ready for trials to pick up again soon. But I mean, it's just like COVID, right? Like when the kind of trials kind of, there's a little lull, it's the perfect time to teach and to learn with these podcasts and webinars.
Yeah, well, we're going to learn a lot today. One of my dear friends and our first Cuban basketball star is here today. I don't think we've had one yet. And so, Lourdes, you're breaking barriers here at Picking Justice. Thank you for coming on. The great Lourdes de Armas, who really is just one of these amazing trial lawyers who's always in trial, has been a good friend of mine over the years. We used to play basketball together a couple times in Humberto Guizar's backyard during COVID. I don't know if you remember that.
I do.
Really?
She was the only girl out there and she was dominating. And I really love that because my mom was a basketball player. She started one of the first women's basketball leagues in the Bay Area. And so I grew up like, you know, real prideful of women's sports. And Lourdes, I love seeing you out there just dominating all these dudes.
Thank you. And at 5'2", it's quite the challenge.
Yeah. Well, you have a great presence in the courtroom, and I've heard you speak on jury selection a few times, and I really just love your practical approach that I've actually used a lot of the stuff that you've taught, and I really can't wait to hear about the way you do it and help our listeners kind of improve if they've never picked a jury, if they've picked 100 juries. You know, there's everything, a lot of things we can learn today from Lourdes de Armas. So, Harry, why don't you kick us off?
Sure. Well, first I want to say, you know, thank God in the courtroom, not on the court, your height doesn't matter. So thank God for me more than anybody else. But in the courtroom, Lourdes, I know that one subject that I've talked about with you, we've all talked about and everybody faces is like, you're talking about damages, especially something that are not financial damages, you know, non-economics. Some people call them non-economics or general damages or pain and suffering. I mean, sometimes for the jurors, what I want to make it clear, I like to say, you know, these are not pocketbook damages. These are not out-of-pocket stuff, financial stuff. But sometimes, right, you get jurors who say, what good is this money going to do? What's the point of the money? Like, and so how do you deal with it when either when they start saying that or preempt them when they start talking about like, what's the point of this money for pain and suffering?
I've seen a shift in the juries before COVID and post-COVID. Before COVID, we could use the terms like human damages, which I hear a lot of attorneys using in referencing non-economics, right? Human loss. It doesn't translate very well anymore just using that terminology. I think that now, especially post-COVID, you have to put things in context a little more. For example, now, instead of saying, you know, the human losses, I talk more about recognizing the loss of health with an amount of money that's equal to the value that's been taken, right? Putting it in context more than just a general term of human losses, I think is a little more helpful.
Was it a change with you or were you seeing jurors kind of responding differently post-COVID?
I'm seeing jurors responding differently post-COVID. They want to see a lot more, I find, at least in the trials I've done. They don't want generalizations, they want specifics. And it carries through all the way to when they're deliberating. You know, for example, I did a trial recently in San Bernardino where the judge gave us a time limitation in jury selection, and I do not do very well in time limitations for some reason or another. And I did not hit upon general damages that much. And in jury selection, and it really hurt us verdict-wise at the end because they thought that they were giving all that they could give based on what they found that my client lacked. And they wanted more from her story on the stand, but without putting it in context of what her actual losses were medically, I think would have made a, maybe, who knows, right? You never know what a jury is going to do, but I think it would have translated more in dollar signs at the end because everyone can understand that.
You're not talking about in jury selection, a function of you had other, like you had to rank your top 2-3 topics you had to go over and just general damages wasn't one of them, or what was your reasoning?
I had my list of topics, and I usually do general damages towards the end. And the judge didn't articulate that she had time limitations at the beginning. And then all of a sudden was like, you have 3 minutes.
There's nothing worse. I mean, obviously, you never want to have 20 minutes. But if you do, you want to know that, because I imagine you would have changed your entire, you know, the way you presented it.
100%. But there was also, you know, very salient topics. It was a police officer that hit my client on duty, and he admitted he was liable. But, you know, there was county issues. My client was also an employee of the county. There were specific other bias types issues that I really needed to address. But now, in retrospect, you know, you do your own postmortem. I think that highlighting general damages, because that's where the value of your verdict comes in, I need to do a better job of that, right? It's the practice of law. We're constantly evolving.
No, that's great. I mean, so tell us kind of what is your strategy and how you present it now? If you don't say, you know, does anyone have an issue awarding millions of dollars for human losses or things like that? How are you kind of introducing the concept?
A little slower, you know, when I don't have time limitations. But most of the time, if the judge does a thorough job and they ask, has anyone been injured? Or I ask that question, has anyone, you know, have anyone been injured in an accident, or has a family member or a friend? And then we talk about the specifics, which each individual juror, to the extent that time and boredom permits, right? Because the last thing you want is to hear 20 stories of someone having someone at home being injured or them being injured, and really getting into how they deal with pain. You know, a lot of our cases, Dan, are chronic pain cases at the end of the day, right? Whether they've had surgery or not. And getting into the specifics, you know, medication-wise, treatment-wise, getting into a lot of those specifics to then circle it back on how everyone deals with pain differently.
Wow, that's interesting. Okay.
And everyone quantifies pain differently. And then, you know, I would get a specific juror that takes care of a mom that's in a wheelchair that is in constant pain, that mom has some good days and some bad days. And just because she has some good days and is able to do a little more things does not mean that the pain has gone away. Kind of instructing the jury on the concept of chronic pain and how it ebbs and flows. And then circling back to my client towards the end, going back to Ms. Smith, you know, we talked a lot about your mom and how your mom deals with pain. Would you agree to wait to hear what my client says on the stand or my client's doctors, and not evaluate your mom's pain with my client's pain, and that my client may deal with pain differently?
I love that, because one thing that you can never assume with a juror who's suffered something similar, like another similar injury or chronic pain, or they have loved ones who do, or they have a kid who does and everything. I just had a recent trial I had, there was somebody on the jury who I felt like on liability would be a great juror. But then I think she mentioned, you know, this juror works with autistic kids and her own child is disabled and everything. And I made sure to have the attorney ask, like, maybe it sounds like, you know, you've maybe seen worse than what my client suffered. In this case, our client, like, she had a very serious like wrist injury and a ton of chronic pain. But we have to admit, as plaintiff lawyers, like, our case is not always the worst harm that your jurors have ever seen. And so is that going to influence how you award damages in a conversation in a case like this? Because some jurors will say, like, hell yeah. Like, I mean, I've seen, this person should be happy. This is all she's got. And some jurors will tell you, absolutely not. I think everybody deals with it differently. And it can, even less than that can be, you know, life-changing. So you can never assume that a juror's experience is going to push them one way or the other, make them good or bad, right?
Harry, I think it's a few of our juries together, we've actually had, I can think of two where we had one was like a pediatric oncologist in the hospital. And so she was just like expressing to us that she sees terrible stuff. And I'm sitting there, like, our client looks totally normal. And I told him we're asking for many millions of dollars. She was probably the biggest hearted person we could have had, but she was basically telling us, she's like, I see worse suffering you can imagine with children. I'm pretty sure we kicked her on, we got her for cause, because I just couldn't award much for someone that I think is not really suffering as much as, you know, I see every day. That's a good point. That's why you do kind of have to ask it that way.
Because someone else in her shoes might have said something completely, they might have said, like, no, I mean, seeing all this suffering just makes me realize that all suffering, no matter how huge or medium or whatever, is all awful, and it's all worth a significant amount of money, versus someone who's saying, like, you know, I've seen so much worse, so what's this person asking for so much money for.
And some of the worst jurors, though, are the ones that fly below the radar, right? They're the ones that have been in an accident and have some sort of level of pain, but didn't really take much medication, didn't do much treatment. And they're living with, you know, I would assume, because I don't ask them what their pain scale is while I'm questioning them, with probably a 3 or 4 daily, and they just continue on with life. And then you have a client that has, you know, a 3 or 4 daily, and sometimes it spikes to a 10. And are they willing to give money to that person and set aside their own feelings and thoughts and what they've endured and still give your client a fair shot based on what your client has suffered? Those are the trickier ones, because they'll say yes and yes, but then, you know, behind the scenes, they're the ones that are like, this isn't worth more than $100,000.
But yeah, with that one, I think, Lourdes, I think the way you said it, I would almost ask that within a question form, exactly how you just said it, you know, and then say, throw it back at them, like, look, I worry about someone like you, and, you know, I'm so sorry what you're going through, but I do worry that if you're dealing with this pain, sounds like you haven't been compensated for that. How do you feel about compensating someone who's dealing with the same pain for you in the millions of dollars? Like, I may just hit it head on and ask that exact concern that I have and tell them it's a worry I have. Harry, what do you think?
I would probably would ask it to someone like that, kind of two different ways. One, I would say, is it something that you kind of have been able to just suck up and not let it affect your quality of life? Because if they tell you, yeah, I'm fine, even if my pain is everything, you know, then I want to get rid of them, because they're thinking an injury and pain is not going to hurt your quality of life. What are you complaining about? Or if, even if they say it does, you know, I still would probably ask them, because there's some jurors who are just so jaded about it. I would say, do you think people are entitled to having a good quality of life? Because some jurors would say, no, life is suffering. I mean, I have chronic pain and I have all these problems and that's just how life is. Like, suck it up. Like, yeah, you want jurors who were like, you know, healthy or happy, but if not healthy, ones who recognize like people should have a right to be healthy and happy. But yeah, there's nothing worse than somebody like Lourdes. If you had that juror, even if they asked their pain scale and they told you it was an 8, if they're like working and they're not complaining and everything, like that seems worse. Like your pain's an 8 right, and you're not, you know, gosh.
My general thought is people who are in chronic pain probably are not going to be good jurors for us. It's not a blanket rule. We don't like to have a black and white rule on this, but to me, I would be very scared of that juror. And then on top of that, the defense is going to strike them. We've talked about this before, Harry, but I mean, they're going to think like, this person's going to be sympathetic to the plaintiff and award a lot of money, when I think the inverse is true.
So when I find somebody on the jury that is in that same scenario, right? They have chronic pain, significant chronic pain. They may even have a limp. They may even tell you that they need to stand up while you're questioning them because their back hurts. I tend to press them a little more and get more of their story and their daily life, because I know that the defense is going to cut them. And if the defense doesn't, I'm going to have to. Because again, you don't want someone comparing their life story to yours. But in a sense, they're educating the jury too, that people do live their lives. They still have to continue. I had, you know, an 80-year-old man, chronic back pain, multiple surgeries, who was still working.
Oh, I've had that case many times, yeah.
Yeah, where you have them describe, why do you keep working? Well, because I have to. Otherwise, I can't pay for the medication. Otherwise, X, Y, and Z, I would be homeless. So you get those stories out. You're educating the jury through a juror that you know you're going to have to lose, or the defense is going to cut anyway.
I'm big on giving a scale, you know, like the middle is neutral. The right would be kind of like the bad juror. The left would be a good juror for me. And I think with a plaintiff who is in chronic pain, you know, if you're lifetime chronic pain, that is worth many millions of dollars, in my opinion. I think you can get a jury there, even if they worked. We've done that before, but I would say, you know, who thinks that someone who keeps working, worked 2 days after the crash, the day after the crash, should never get millions of dollars? I think I would just kind of just throw it out there like that. I don't know, Harry, how would you kind of introduce that with the normal looking or chronic or back to work plaintiff?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few ways I've done it, and there's no, they're all pretty good, depending on how you do it. Sometimes if your client's back to work, I like to say, you know, one worry I have is that you're going to hear my client is suffering a lot, but he or she has been able to, had to suck it up and has gone back to work and hasn't missed a day. And I worry that some people hear that and they think, if somebody can work, that must mean they're not that injured. And other people feel a different way. And how do you feel about it? And you'll have a lot of jurors, like, you know, we've seen it, Dan, where they're like, you know, in the Munguia case, I mean, you know, people were like, he probably had no choice. I mean, but then you get other people who are like, yeah, you can't be that hurt if you're working.
But it's really tight. The next step, though, is like the millions of dollars.
You know? That's how I like to say, anyone think that, do you think that if they're working, they can't be seriously injured enough to warrant millions of dollars and everything like that? Because some people will say, you know, like, well, I mean, it might be hurt, but he can't be that hurt. And that's really where you kind of tie it in, I think.
But I was also going to say, you know, when you're telling the jurors that you're going to be asking for millions, and would you be willing to, you know, award millions at the end of the case? I think also it has to be put into context as well, that it's not an award. They're not making a profit. It isn't a payday, which is what a lot of them think when, you know, you start talking about that kind of money and putting it in context that it's, you know, really doesn't matter if you give them millions. It's a partial reimbursement for what's already been taken away by the way of their health, that they're never going to be made whole. And putting it into context without mentioning your client, but putting it, you know, like Mr. Albert just described his life day in and day out, where he's always in pain and he still goes to work. Even if he was awarded millions of dollars, he's never going to be the same. It's a partial reimbursement for what's already been taken away. Kind of, I believe now more when, you know, picking the jury, putting things in context, giving analogies kind of helps tell a story, because then tying it together in closing can use the snippets of what some of the potential jurors said during jury selection and remind them of what they said by, you know, just putting it into context.
That's interesting. I haven't really heard the reimbursement, but I kind of like it. I mean, I really do. It's a partial reimbursement, because a full reimbursement would be
back to normal.
This never happened. Yeah, back to normal. This never happened. And you can never fully reimburse because you can't turn back time. Yeah, I like that a lot. So are you introducing that concept in jury selection? Like, this is, just tell us how you asked that, or like, what's your segue from, maybe you're talking about the cop or suing the county or something like that, and then you're finally on your kind of your list on general damages. What's your, like, I love to hear about people's segue.
Right. Well, hopefully at some point someone brings up the hot coffee case, because that's an easier segue to talk about it. Because when they do, I tell them, you know, that's a case of not knowing all the facts, right? What if you knew, just liability-wise, that specific McDonald's from corporate was told that the coffee was too hot and that it had to be, you know, below a certain degrees? And what if you found out through the evidence that it was, you know, five times higher than that? And what if you found out that the cap wasn't correctly put? And what if you found out that it was third degree burns that completely debilitated this woman's life? Change your mind.
You're doing all this and you're explaining that case and the judge not shutting
the judge, I've never had a judge shut it down. And I only go that deep when the jurors are talking about plaintiff's attorneys and there's too many lawsuits and the verdicts are too high. And they have, I sense that there's more than one juror that has a complete distrust of the system. They're not buying it. They can't really get behind giving millions of dollars for an injury. And I don't introduce the case. If someone does introduce the case and they say, yeah, you know, just like that hot coffee case, then that gives me a segue because they brought it up.
Can I play devil's advocate?
Yes.
But I guess if those are going to be your bad jurors, right, why are you even trying to kind of change their mind on how they're viewing that case, or plaintiff lawyers in general? Because if they're throwing out there like, hey, I don't like lawyers, I can't stand this award for pain and suffering, just look at the McDonald's hot coffee case, that's ridiculous, that's bullshit, like, I can never get behind something like that, I think all these cases are, you know, blah, 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 blah. I mean, is there a reason not to just like kind of let that sit and be like, anyone else sort of feel that way a little bit? I'm just curious, what is your thinking about introducing the facts of that specific case? What is your goal there with the jury?
To show that there's, well, first to show that there's some sort of confirmation bias, that, you know, there's always an underscore, that if there's a level of mistrust, maybe their initial thinking or that bias that they came in the door was not fully informed, right? They have a perception based on what they heard without really knowing all the facts. And then I always tie that back in. You're willing to listen to the facts of the case. You're willing to listen to the evidence of this case, because at the beginning, it may not sound like what you think it is. If you wait until the end before you render judgment, you'll see that a different story can be told. So it's always relating it back to what they may hear so that they don't make a snap judgment. Sometimes it's not about the individual juror that's giving me the information. It's about educating the rest of them to not have similar feelings. And if, you know, it's the ones that are on the fence that you could tilt one way or another that I'm trying to tilt the way that I need them to. When they hear evidence that might not be favorable, they don't automatically jump, well, That's right. All plaintiffs' attorneys are shysters, right? I'm trying to avoid the confirmation bias that goes on in humanity to begin with. And maybe I'm overthinking it. I don't know.
I guess my fear, and look, this is totally an art, 100%. I mean, everyone does it very different. You have great success doing it. I guess my fear would be just a little bit of that. Like, it would just kind of, I may have like sort of rehabbed the bad juror for me. I may have rehabbed him because maybe he's like, oh, maybe you're right. Maybe like these cases aren't all that bad. You know, I don't know. Who knows, Harry? What do you think? I mean, you tried more cases than both of us.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different ways you can take the McDonald's coffee case. But yeah, I mean, I agree with Lourdes that I really want to know when they bring it up what issue they have with it, because it really matters to me. Some of them kind of feel like that's just an absurd, you know, you spilled coffee on yourself. It's like, and you got millions of dollars. I mean, I think it was only like 1 point something million.
I think it was two. I thought it was 2.1 or whatever.
Yeah, whatever. Well, it wasn't like some enormous verdict, but maybe back then it was.
It was Texas, right? Wasn't it in Texas?
It was in Oregon, I think. I can't remember.
Come on, Lourdes, you sound like you know all the facts.
All I know is that the corporate is in Chicago, and Chicago fined them multiple times for how hot their coffee was.
Okay. Yes, it might have been that. Yeah, I can't remember when it was. But anyway, so I want to know, like, some jurors, I mean, I like asking them, like, what was it that bothered you about that case? Was it that somebody did something they should take personal responsibility for spilling it, or that they just shouldn't get that much money, or what? You know, because I can deal with people who just kind of feel like, oh, it just seemed like a lot of money because they don't know almost nobody knows how bad the burns were. They just hear the coffee. But, you know, and then I think you use it as a jury selection tool to say, because some people feel like personal responsibility means if you do something stupid, you shouldn't blame anybody else but yourself. Even if somebody else, you know, like McDonald's, maybe the coffee was way too hot and spilling that coffee shouldn't have meant you got way more injured than you should have been. But some people feel like personal responsibility means you just get your fair share of the blame and somebody else should get their fair share of the blame too. And how do you feel about that? Because there are a lot of jurors, even in LA where, you know, everyone thinks that the jurors are super pro plaintiff. There are a lot of jurors who think if you do something stupid, don't blame anybody else. So, you know, there's no such thing as, you know, 50-50. It's like, come on, plaintiff, like you get nothing because you did something stupid.
I really like that a lot because I guess when the hot coffee comes up, I'm trying to think how I even react. I think I just kind of brush it aside. I don't even know what
I mean, I get someone thinking like you spilled coffee on yourself and coffee is hot and that's stupid and you should have been careful. Like, I agree with all that.
Yeah.
But then the thing that you want to eventually show the jurors, like if you were trying that case, right, would be like, you know, sometimes I've used an analogy, like if you spilled some coffee on yourself, what would you expect would happen to you or could happen to you? And the jurors would be like, oh, it's hot and it hurts. And like, would you expect to have to go to the hospital? You know, you could ask that if you wanted to. And I bet most jurors would probably be like, yeah, no, I mean, it's coffee, like, you know, so, but I don't mind them thinking that she should have some fault. But if anybody thinks like she should blame nobody but herself, she shouldn't assume that the coffee was even, you know, under 200 degrees or 300 degrees, like that's a terrible juror.
So that's so interesting because you're taking what I think most lawyers, at least I'm guilty of it, is I think of the McDonald's hot coffee is people are biased against awarding money, like that much money for something so silly. But you're turning it into, like I always thought of it as a damages thing, but it's more of a almost a liability.
For some jurors it is. Some jurors just did money. So they're like millions of dollars for coffee, that sounds crazy. And I think they don't know how hurt she was.
Yeah, and the way that I try to use it is not only for liability, but to put it into context that everyone deals with injury differently and the injury is more severe than what was perceived. Right? Spilling hot coffee to some people is just, you know, it turns red for a couple of hours and you have to put some ointment and she should have been fine. But when they find out that it was really severe third degree burns, I mean, obviously I don't go into that kind of detail that she had skin grafting and all of that. But when, you know, you put it into context, it was a real severe injury that really affected her life. You know, you can tie that back into general damages on how your perception can't be clouded until you see all the evidence, you know, and most of the time trials, and you can say that at the beginning to the jury when you're starting to question them, in most trials, it's not a fight about facts, it's a fight about the conclusion of the facts, right? The person had the injury, whether it's spine or a knee. The experts are fighting about what their conclusions of those facts are, whether it's a disc bulge versus degenerative changes that have been there from the beginning. And even those, it's a fight about the conclusion. Did that degenerative change become exacerbated because of the accident, or is the pain just pre-existing, right? So it's a fight about conclusions and putting it into context with them that we're here, not because we're asking for millions of dollars and we're being greedy, but because there's a genuine dispute about the conclusions of the case and the damages, I think, and I hope, it kind of helps to present it in a way that, look, we're not the greedy, we're not, it's not a money grab, it is not a lottery at the end of the day, that we're here for a particular reason, and the only reason we're here is a dispute that you, the jurors, can resolve. And that's why it's important.
Yeah, no, I love that. So you take that, and then if it doesn't come up, hypothetically, what is your...
You just bring it up, don't you?
No, I don't.
You just grab your little McDonald's coffee cup and go, oops, oh, did...
Oh, yeah. Does this look familiar to anybody?
Is this it? Even though this is Chick-fil-A?
Yeah, yeah. But
Arches.
What is your segue to talking about, you know, non-economic damages?
I like to give signposts. You know, I'm talking about, let's go on this topic and I question them about it. And then, you know, now I talk about how at the end of the trial, what they're going to do is fill out a form. And in filling out that form, they have to decide two specific areas. The easy one is what we call economic damages. It's, you know, numbers that are tangible. You can touch and feel them. You can see them. They're easily articulated, whether it's lost income, medical expenses, actually something that one of our experts and their experts is going to put a specific number on the board. But then there is a more general one, which is called general damages. And then I get into that, you know, and how it's recognizing the loss of health, the amount of money equal to the value of what was taken to that person and how that person values their loss, not how someone else would value that loss. So it's very important that we listen to, you know, the testimony. And then by that time, I've been talking to a few jurors about their own pain experiences or family experiences and experiences with loss, and then get a commitment from them that they're not going to compare the two. That what my client values their loss to be may not be what they would if it was their injury and the way that they deal with the pain. So kind of put the concept that, yes, it's up to them. They're the appraisers. But the eye of the appraiser is not from what they would do personally and what they would want personally. It's from what the evidence that they heard and how my client suffered.
All right. Let's take a moment to thank our wonderful sponsors who make all this possible. First off is Baldwin Settlements. Fantastic structured settlement company with the founder and owner, Melissa Baldwin, who gives back all the time to the plaintiff's bar with CALA, CAOC, AAJ. She really is the go-to structured settlement company in person. Baldwin Settlements, they work with clients to really get them set up for the rest of their lives. I worked with her on the big damages case. We represented someone who was seriously injured, but his demons, he was a drug addict, kind of in and out of homelessness, got him a big settlement. And she was able to speak at his level and convince him that he needed to have a structured settlement to get himself set up for himself and, you know, his siblings who were taking care of him for the rest of his life. And she's just able to really relate to these clients. And not only does she relate well with the client, she's very accessible. I mean, she will text, call when she's on vacation, nights, weekends, which is what you need with a structured person. She can deal with mediators, the other side's structure person, and she can also get great rates on attorneys for their fees. So I highly recommend Melissa Baldwin, Baldwin Settlements, very dear friend of mine and a huge supporter of the plaintiff's bar. So Baldwin Settlements, thank you for sponsoring.
And for their contact information, just reach out to Dan or I at Picking Justice if you want contact information for any of these folks, because they're amazing. Our other sponsor, Motion Lit, I mean, they do it all. They're technically like a trial technology company, but they do what? Settlement docs. Let me know if I'm missing anything, Dan. Settlement docs, trial technology, animations, graphics. What am I missing here? I'm sure there's a couple other things.
I mean, I've worked with Motion Lit for a very long time. Vahe and Vache, they're wonderful people. They really understand what it takes graphically to tell a plaintiff's story in opening, closing, any imaging you need, animations. We use them a lot for surgery animations because not only are they really good and accurate, they have a great team of animators, but they're also affordable. Frankly, like, their prices are hard to beat. And we've shopped around, you know, but we love Motion Lit. We love their work. Jurors love their animations. So they got all tech support, depositions, like you said, settlement videos. Their animations are fantastic. Just really good people to work with. And they're huge supporters of the Plaintiff's Bar. And I think it's important, the business partners that we team up with, that they support what we do and our causes and all that. And Motion Lit has always been there for that. And they're just really good to work with. And just like Melissa Baldwin, they're very accessible and just good dudes. Fahey and Vache from Motionlit.
And involved in the Altadena fire litigation because they actually lost their office in the Altadena fires. Their office was in Altadena. So get in touch with them for that case or any other trial that you got coming up there at motionlit.com. And they're terrific.
Yeah, no, they're great. And then our final sponsor, who's new to Picking Justice, Four Corners. It is a deposition summary company. We have been using Four Corners in my office for, God, it's probably been 8 years, maybe more. Really just a fantastic company that they will summarize your depositions quickly. We literally, every time we come in a case, because we get a lot of cases referred from other lawyers where depos have been taken, we just immediately, right away, send them all our depos and we get these great, accurate summaries back quickly. And they just make it so easy for any firm, frankly, that is litigating cases, but especially trial firms. If you have a case where you have, you know, 10, 15, 20 depositions, you really need a good summary so you can get up to speed quickly. We love their summaries. I mean, Frank, KTL, this is, we use them for every single case, all summaries. We trust them with the work. They're quick, they're affordable, just really good, like I said, good people to work with, big supporters of the plaintiff's bar as well. So Four Corners, I highly recommend getting all your depos summarized by them. Even on cases that you have, as soon as we take a depo, we have a standing order in our office that as soon as the depo's done, as soon as we get the transcript in, my team sends it to Four Corners, gets summarized, and then boom, we are just ready to rock and roll for trial or preparing for other depositions. So Four Corners deposition summary is fantastic. Harry, you have the contact information for them?
I do. Yeah. If you want contact information for Four Corners and their owner operator, Sheila, who is amazing. Yeah. Reach out to us and we'll get it to you.
All right. Thank you to the sponsors, Baldwin Settlements, Motionlit, and Four Corners. All right. Let's get back to the show.
And then do you ask a group question? Like, does anyone feel that no matter what the evidence shows, the value can never be over $1 million? Or where do you kind of go from there?
Yeah, there's a few questions like that. You know, is there a ceiling to how much you would be willing to award? But also, you know, I tell them that the law provides, you know, it's the law that provides the remedy. It's not something that we're just merely asking for. The law wants you to recognize the loss. And there will be rules that the judge reads to you about certain specifics of what they're entitled to be awarded for. And then I ask them, you know, are there some of you that are just not buying it? That it doesn't matter how much has been lost. It doesn't matter how much my client testifies or the family members and the doctors articulate has suffered. You just do not feel comfortable giving any amount. And then I go up, if the judge allows me to say millions, that we're asking for millions, is there a particular amount that you're not willing to give? And then most of the time, they're very open, right? Because by that time, you've gotten them talking on other topics. You've kind of warmed them up and prime them, which is why I usually deal with it at the end. Although my first trial with Harry is next month. Maybe he's going to change the order of the way I do it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, don't worry. You're going to change the way you do it.
I'm just going to change things just to change them. I'm like an interior decorator. Do. I'm like, this is all wrong.
Yeah, no, the way you're doing it, I don't like that. Because now he's hearing how I do things. He's like, yep, nope, nope, nope. But, you know, then I guide them to it because we've already had those conversations. And there's already people that I can go to that can help fill in the blanks of the narrative that I'm trying to evolve in front of the jury with non-economic damages.
I've talked to some lawyers who put up the, you know, in California, jury, it's 3905A, which is like the list of the non-economic damages, which technically you could put anything in there, is what I'm realizing. Like I have my buddy David Rudorf went to trial and he had like 36 items listed on there. And the judge allowed it. Yeah, well, because it says in the jury instruction, it says like these are the non-economic damages. And it's in parentheses and it says like physical pain, mental suffering, humiliation, anxiety. I don't know. You probably know them, Lourdes, by heart. But it has like 9 of them listed. And so that's the 9 that everyone usually goes with. But then it says whatever else applies. So, I mean, you really could honestly just put whatever the damage is, if you, you know, get a dictionary or a thesaurus, put it in there. So anyway, my question is, I've heard some attorneys who kind of put a poster board up or put it on a screen and say, like, put the list, be like, what do you think about awarding money for anxiety? And then just like go through each one. So they're already thinking about the different items. Have you ever done that?
No.
Would you do it? What are your thoughts on it?
I don't know. It wouldn't come natural to me. I would have to try to introduce it in some cases and then fully expand upon it. I mean, that's one of the things that I find, you know, if I hear somebody do it and it doesn't, is not natural or authentic to me, I'm scared to try it unless I practice it, right? But if my client does, you know, I have a trial that's going to happen in June that is, you know, an assault case. And the basis of her claim, our damages, are PTSD. And anxiety is a huge one. So in that one, I think, yeah, that would be a great question to ask the jurors. How do you feel about, you know, awarding damages for anxiety? And, you know, what kind of things are you looking to hear? And hopefully some people have some sort of anxiety in their past, because you can ask that, right? Has anyone ever dealt with anxiety or depression or anything like that? And again, bringing it back to how everyone deals with things differently. What may cause me anxiety does not necessarily cause you anxiety, without getting too case specific, right? Because some judges are like, oh, you're getting too much into the case.
Well, I mean, and I'd love to hear Harry's thoughts on the PTSD. I mean, Harry has gotten with David DiRoberto and a bunch of other employment lawyers, like where it's literally, that's all. There is no physical injury. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like, so, I mean, does anyone think that emotional stress or PTSD can be just as valuable, if not more, than a physical injury? Or does anyone think the opposite? Harry, how do you kind of approach that?
I like to choose the best words that I can that sound the most positive. So I probably would never say anxiety or even PTSD, but I would, like, so in employment cases with David and his mini and his voir dire and everything, we say things like, if we can't say quality of life, like, do you think peace of mind, you know, is important to you? And things like that, depending on what happens in the case. But I would use like emotional well-being. Like, so you think someone's mental health or emotional well-being is valuable? I probably would only go through certain categories in voir dire if my case was really mostly, or the damages were mostly like one or two of them. Like if you have all of them across the board, I wouldn't go through each one of them. And because like, what are you going to do if someone's like, I totally am okay with 16 of those, but these two I think are bullshit. Like, what are you going to strike that guy? I mean, probably not.
No, absolutely not. I'm keeping that motherfucker on my jury.
Yeah. So how many of you, you're okay with 21 of the 26 of my categories, you know, and this guy's okay with 19.
The defense is like cause for plaintiff.
Right. Yeah. Just one category. Yeah.
In that regard, another concept that I try to introduce in the realm of, you know, general damages is also invisible injuries, because it spans and encompasses a lot of things. Emotional, also spine injuries that aren't necessarily create a physical manifestation that you can see when someone walks in. Even, you know, TBI.
Well, TBI. Yeah, I was going to say, yeah. TBI is a big one.
So I talked to them about, you know, how all the jurors would love to see a case where the client comes in a wheelchair or has a cane, a physical manifestation of an injury that you can see every day, day in and day out. So you know for sure that they're injured. But how do you feel about a case when you saw my client get up and leave the room? Because I always have my client leave the room during jury selection.
Yep.
That you can't tell that they're injured. They look just like one of you that is living your life normally. How do you feel about those types of cases where you have to wait and listen to all the evidence in order for, you know, how much evidence do you feel you need? Are we already starting behind the eight ball? Are we starting behind because my client looks normal by just looking at them? Or are we even? Because, you know, the law says we're supposed to be even at this point.
I just want to make sure this is not lost in what Lourdes said, because I do the same thing. And I think it's very important in these type of normal looking plaintiff cases, quote unquote, normal looking, is I do have them. The judge will ask, my client will be sitting like next to counsel table or at counsel table. And then I may get up and do my brutal honesty biases kind of whatever. And then I'll say, oh, and then I'll have her walk up and then just like wait and watch her walk so that everyone's watching her and make sure all eyes are on her until the doors close. And then maybe I'll kind of introduce this, what I taught with brutal honesty. I want you because she's not here. But more importantly, then I'll bring it back to what you just said, Lourdes, is like, I want to talk about, you know, awarding the type of money we're talking about for someone that looks normal. You just saw her walk out of here normal. And who does that rub the wrong way? I've always had a few of them say, like, there's no way. She looks fine. I don't care what the evidence shows. Like, and then you'll get other jurors who will say the opposite. Like, they'll be like, are you kidding me? Like, my dad works every day and he's just dealing with terrible pain. He is like, can't sleep at night. Or them jurors themselves will look normal from the outside, but you can never tell what's going on the inside. So,
Dan, you just said something that I think it's very important to your listeners to understand, is you said, does this rub anyone the wrong way? And what's important about that is that you used everyday words. You did not introduce a legal concept that's not easily understandable. You used normal language. And I think that when I started to see bigger verdicts is when I actually, you know, read that Mitnick book that we all read and realized that he spoke like a normal person and got good results. And it changed the way that I articulated my thoughts and started just speaking normally. And by just using that simple phrase, does it rub you the wrong way? Everyone can understand that. And everyone has, you know, feeling for or against what you just said in a way that it will engage conversation. Because most of the jurors, as you know, have what, a ninth grade, eighth grade education for the most part or understanding. And we as attorneys are really trying to impress. Who are we impressing with big language and asking these compound questions that nobody understands?
Yeah, I've read all the same books. And I think it also doesn't force the jurors into a box because no one likes to be put into like, you are a biased person. You are in this box. You cannot stand normal looking people. It's just like, it bothers me. Bad taste in my mouth, rubs me the wrong. Like, I think it just, it gives them a leeway that they lean a little bit one way or another. Because no one likes to be like an outcast from the group, right? Or just by themselves on an island. So I think it's important to give the jurors that they can be part of a group, and maybe that group is just not good. Like, this is not the right case for them. So Harry, what are you thinking?
Well, first of all, I want to thank Lourdes for assuming that we have listeners. I appreciate that. But this is a live, this is actually, I don't, we didn't tell her this is a live webinar. Yeah. There's nobody watching. But anyway, I'm just kidding.
This is a pass for when we work together next month, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, yeah, getting people feeling comfortable and using regular people language. I mean, that's the only way you can get them talking. I've seen so many defense lawyers just get up there and, but getting back on track, I mean, I remember you said a little while ago that I caught my attention was you talked about, I don't remember you used the word windfall, but something like a, like an award or something for somebody. And how do you handle it when you hear, because I, every time, occasionally I'll hear jurors talk about, you know, windfall. Well, I'm not going to give the plaintiff a windfall. You're talking about the damages or something like that. How do you handle it when someone throws a word like that out there?
It's always a word you don't want to hear, but then bring it back to, that's always the misconception, right? That even it doesn't matter how much they award, they can award the biggest number that they could ever imagine, and it still will not make him walk correctly. It still will not take away the pain. So it's not really him winning the lottery. You're not awarding him something for him to make a profit. You are trying to reimburse, partial reimbursement for what was already taken that is never going to be put back whole. It's kind of like an egg. Right. And we use the eggshell analogy a lot, you know, in closing. And I have, you know, the progression of the egg getting worse is, you know, an egg that was whole gets dropped and it may not fall apart, but it's cracked. And it doesn't matter how much money you give him. It doesn't matter how much gold polish that money is going to polish on that egg. The cracks are still going to be there. And, you know, can you agree that someone that has an injury that is now, because our case together, he walks with a limp, he is never going to walk correctly. His leg is still going to be longer than his left leg. So it doesn't matter how much you give him. Does everyone understand that concept that the law is giving you the remedy in order to compensate him, that it is not a lottery, it's not a winning, it's what the law allows for?
Yeah, no, I like that. I think that maybe gives you a good opportunity to introduce the concepts of both appraising the loss of quality of life and then also introducing the concept of the money's really coming from insurance. So they throw you the windfall thing. So the judge is going to say it doesn't matter where the money's going. Your job is just to be an appraiser. Are you familiar with what an appraiser is? And then you kind of get maybe a little dialogue there. And your job is just to say, this is the value. And that's it. That's all you have to do. You don't have to consider where the money's going. You don't even have to consider where the money's coming from. Do you know where the money's coming from, for example, especially when you have a non-corporate defendant out there?
Yeah.
Like, do you know? Because my concern when I hear windfall is that you're thinking it may be coming from someone and going, you know, directly to someone else. What do you think about that idea when we're talking these numbers? And then I think I can get them kind of talking on how they feel. And then after that, I may, talking about appraising, I may have introduced the concept of, you think there's anything more valuable than the loss of quality of life? And this is all stuff that Harry's kind of really helped me change the way I talk about non-economic damages is, you know, your job is going to be appraising the loss of quality of life. Do you think there's anything more valuable than that? And see what they say. Maybe they say, well, blah, 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 blah. And then I'll say, well, what about, you know, lifetime of paychecks or a mansion, a yacht? Do you think that those things are more valuable that are, you know, $5, $10 million, $20 million? Do you think those things are more valuable than the loss of quality of life? How do you feel about that? So I think maybe I would like kind of maybe throw that back at them, Harry. I mean, yeah. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I think most, and the people who think that, if think about it in terms of windfall, there's kind of two ways of thinking about it. There's some people who are like, who understand like this is an exchange, like it's got to be the value of someone's quality of life. But there's some jurors, the ones who bring up the windfall are the kind of jurors who kind of think, they basically tell you like, I don't think a person should be profiting off their own injury. So they're almost thinking like, this thing has already happened. It's like, it's done. So why are you getting all this money like after the fact? Why are you profiting it? And they don't understand, you know, so that's why sometimes I like to ask those jurors, sometimes even if they don't bring it up, I like to have the attorney say, sometimes people will say it's a windfall if they get a lot of money, as if that's something that they would like happily trade their quality of life for a few million dollars, or their loved one if it's a death case for a few million dollars. How do you feel about that? So I think to some degree, you got to reframe it, but you're also looking for the people who kind of say, at the end of the day, the people who think it's a windfall are like, why are you getting millions of dollars when this thing's already happened and there's nothing, there's no turning back? You know, I think so important to explain to jurors and exclude jurors who don't agree with you to think like the money here is not at all to fix anything. You know, in an injury case, I love the lawyers to say, let me just make it clear. We're here asking for that money because all the medical care in the world is never going to give this person their quality of life back. That's gone. That's gone. And so your job is to put a value on what's been taken. And if you believe the quality of life is something that actually is valuable. And what are your thoughts about whether that system is fair? Because some jurors will tell you, I don't think it's fair. Why should they get money for quality of life?
And then also, I mean, with the whole windfall thing, I know I kind of touched on it, but it really does give you the opportunity to just be like, you know, when I hear windfall, and I do have a concern, you know, we're talking these numbers, there's a 16-year-old kid on the other side. I wouldn't say kid, but there's a 16-year-old driver on the other side. Would you be worried about, even if we prove that it's in the millions of dollars, where the money comes from? Because that person's going to say yes, right? And if I've already believed that based on other answers that person's giving me, they're going to be bad. I would probably just use the windfall and then get them to say they will cannot be 100% neutral because they'll always have in the back of their mind where the money's coming from, right?
Is what you're telling me that you don't agree with, you think it's kind of unfair to have somebody have to pay a lot of money or receive a lot of money for something that the money's not going to change anything? Because that's not how our system works, but it wouldn't be fair for us to force our jurors to enforce a law that you don't agree with. Are you telling me that you kind of disagree with the system? You don't think it's right? And that's fine to get rid of them for that reason. And so, yeah, I think you use the windfall thing to definitely get rid of some people, but people haven't thought about it. They go, yeah, it sounds like a windfall. If you explain it in a good way and they kind of get it, they'll tell you they get it. And if they tell you they don't, they tell you they don't.
Yeah. And also, I mean, I like what Dan said about putting them in place of appraising a loss, because you can also put it into context by saying the non-economics, the money that you would award for the medical expenses that have already been expended and the loss of past income, that will fix the problem, right? You return the money that's already been spent, and the future medical costs, that's, you know, he'll testimony that that's going to happen. He needs those future surgeries. So that'll fix the problem of him needing those surgeries. The money that you're going to be giving for general damages will not fix the problem.
Exactly. And one thing that I really like in the last couple of jury selections I've been with Mr. Rowley is that the point of the money is it's got to be enough money that that person can't complain about what was taken from them. Like, ooh, we've given you this much money and now you can't complain about it. And if you can still complain about it, that's not enough money. I like the idea of doing that with economic damages too. Like if you give someone back all the money they would have made, you can't complain about losing that paycheck. You got the money. But if your quality of life is also destroyed, that's you're owed something too, right? Or do you disagree with that, that you're not owed something? So I like that concept because so many jurors just struggle with, and sometimes we even explain it and we talk about non-economics, you still get jurors coming back and saying things like, oh yeah, I think it's important because money can help them with their medical treatment or if they need therapy or if they, you know, if they need money to survive and pay their bills because they can't work. And you're like, well, we just talked about that. That's something different. So sometimes you have to explain non-economics multiple times to a jury because they just don't get it. So I always tell lawyers, listen to what your jurors are saying, be willing to and ready to explain it over and over again to them because sometimes they're not listening.
Well, and then you tie that into closing, right? When you know that there are a few jurors that got left on the panel that really struggled with the concept of non-economics, and you know you have to spend a little more time in closing reiterating, you know, the points that were made and what non-economics are in order to get them to fully understand when they go in the back. I always, you know, have court reporters taking down jury selection. And then I actually look at it when I'm preparing my closing, you know, the ones that were left on, what did they say? What were their jobs? Is there a way that I can incorporate things that they, their own life experiences into my closing in order for it to resonate with them? Because I will die on this cross that says jurors really don't remember specific facts throughout, but they always will remember how you made them feel. And if there's anything that you can make them feel while they're in the back, because it resonated with them, their personal experience, I think the better, hopefully.
Yeah. I mean, I think definitely think trying to get to know your jurors, bringing their personal experiences into your closing makes a huge difference and it really impacts them. But since we're almost out of time, Lourdes, I do want to ask you, because you've tried a lot of cases, and what are some of the things you used to do in jury selection that you're just like, look back and you're like, man, I can't believe I used to do it that way. I mean, I have a huge list for myself, but I'm curious what things that you know, maybe you could advise some newer lawyers who haven't really tried a lot of cases, and you know, because I want them to learn from our mistakes, frankly.
There's two major things. One is I used to write out all the questions that I was going to ask. And then it was kind of like a formulaic script. And for me, anything that's formulaic, I get tripped up if things don't go the way that I want them to off the script, right? You lose your place and it doesn't come off as natural. The other thing that I used to do that I don't do anymore is ask open-ended questions to the group, raise your hand if. Because that, to me, at least my experience, does not facilitate them opening up. Because what happens when you've asked three questions in a row and no one's raised their hand?
You go individual? You go one by one?
For the most part, I do. Maybe the opening question would be like, can we all agree that my client not being here, you know, was a decision I made. You're not going to hold it against him because I want you to be, you know, as open and honest as possible, you know, and to have them raise their hand, get used to that concept. But I don't start my questioning off with that. And I see a lot of attorneys doing that. Well, they say, how many people think there are too many lawsuits? And then nobody raises their hand. That doesn't facilitate an open conversation, because what you want, at least from my perspective, is to have the juror feel comfortable enough to talk to you. So I'll ask, Mrs. Smith, do you feel that there's too many lawsuits? And then why or why not? No, there aren't any. Because now you're giving them not just the option, raise your hand if there are there? And if you don't agree that there are, why do you feel that way? And then open it up, who else feels that way? Or who else disagrees with Mrs. Smith? So before I would stand back behind the podium and speak to the group as a whole. Now I'm more impersonal. And I think, you know, Dan, you can agree. And Harry, that comes with experience and comfortability in your own skin. Now I actually focus on the person I'm talking to, because that's what we do in conversation. And it makes them open up a little more because they feel they're being heard. The last thing someone wants is when you ask them a question and you want to know the bad things that they're thinking, right? They're vulnerable and you're looking away.
Any advice for our newer, and I know you hate the word female trial lawyer or woman trial lawyer, which I agree with you. Everyone's just a trial lawyer, and there's great of both sexes and not great at both sexes. But any advice for a young woman out there trying her first case?
Yes, especially when you're picking a jury, is use words that are authentic to you. Do not try to be formulaic. Do not memorize a transcript of, you know, Rowley doing jury selection.
Or Brian Panish, yeah.
Or Brian Panish. I mean, attend those classes, but don't attend those classes to try to speak word for word from what that one person is telling you to do. Like, don't be a robot. Do not come in with a script. Come in with a set of topics that you want to ask, and ask the questions in a way that's authentic to you. And you'll find you'll do a lot better.
I agree 100%. You really just, men, women, whoever you're out there, you know, young, old, whatever, like, just be yourself. You're creating your own style. And the more authentic you are to that, the more vulnerable you are, and also the more confidence you'll have, frankly, because it's like, if you have an accent, that's just who you are. And people understand in our today's society, if you're confident in what you're saying and you believe in your case and your client, it'll come through to the jurors and it'll help you win your trial.
And the second advice I would give, because I think that, you know, when you hear the elder statesmen, the Supremes, talk about psychoanalyzing a jury and preempting certain issues and what do you call that? Conditioning or preconditioning and all of that. If you put all of that aside and you focus on getting the jurors to talk, where they're talking more than you're talking, you're actually going to get information of which jurors are really going to hurt your case in the back. And that should be your number one priority when you're first starting out. None of the psychobabble, the preconditioning, or, you know, getting this for getting them to see you as the leader, or figuring out who the leader is amongst the jurors. You're not there yet. I'm not there yet.
That's such a great point, Lourdes. And we talked to Ricardo Echeverri, who's one of these, I would say, elder statesmen, who's just an amazing speaker. He always wins it for people on Trial Lawyer of the Year, and he just gives these great closings. But he admitted, he's like, my jury selection is pretty boring. And we talked about it. It's like, you don't try to be Cicero in jury selection. You're there to get data and get information. In fact, some of the best jury selections, Harry, I've heard you say, are the most boring ones. You're not trying to be the Rico Suave and charm the socks off them, because you may, but those people who love you and are smiling and with you and flirting with you, whatever, they're going to fucking defense you. So, right. You know, because you haven't learned anything about them or their biases.
Yeah, it's just, you're not the star of the jury selection. I mean, they're the stars. They're the actors. You're the director. And if you're not letting them talk, you're not learning anything. Unless, and maybe you're thinking you're changing their minds just by sitting there talking the whole time, but we all know that's not true. And if you're such a great speaker and you're so persuasive, you're probably going to win anyway. So why even, you're not going to win in jury selection.
And defense does that a lot, if you notice. You know, after you spend a couple hours questioning the jurors, they get up with a formula in a script that they, you know, they give in every single case that elicits no information, except try to rehabilitate the ones that were on the fence.
With that, thank you, Lourdes DeArmas at Omega. She is a fantastic trial lawyer. I'm so excited you're finally working with the great Harry Plotkin.
Yes, I am too.
Make sure you don't settle. I want to see that verdict.
Me too. They've offered my client money, but so far he's holding tight.
Good. Hold tight. Get a verdict. Thank you so much for being here. You're a very good friend of mine. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And with that, we will end today's episode. Thank you to Law Pods, as always, for making this possible and for allowing us a platform to help educate trial lawyers out there so they can go win verdicts for their clients. So thank you very much for this episode of Picking Justice.
If you're enjoying the podcast, the best compliment you can give us is sharing it with a colleague who would find it valuable. For all the best clips from the podcast, follow us on social media. You can find those links in the show notes. Have a jury selection story to share? Email us at podcast@pickingjustice.com and we may address it in a future episode. Until next time, remember, you're not just picking a jury, you're picking justice. Produced and powered by Law Pods.